Absolutely. Yeah. But if you're going to testify, protocol, and the chair, most chairs give them one.
That was a compliment to me.
That was a compliment.
I would call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this wonderful Friday, March 13th, and make a couple of announcements. First, I'm carrying over House Bill 2541 to Monday, and I will not be opening up a work session today on House Bill 2247 or 2048. So if you're here to see what we're going to do with those magical bills, not today.
2048.
What we're going to do is I'm going to open up a work session to move 2110 to a different committee, and then we'll have a couple of public hearings.
2247 so, and 2048.
Okay. We have enough people here.
Hold on. One, two, three, four. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Open a work session on House Bill 2110 for the purpose of moving it to the tax credit joint committee on tax credits.
Moving for a motion, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2110 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2110 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion on that bill? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Pardon me?
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Kenmer?
Excused.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries, and 2110 is on its way to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. I'm going to open a...
You're supposed to ask for to be excused if you're...
A public hearing on House Bill 3021. Will you tell us what we have here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3021. I'm going to tell you what the bill does, but actually we are looking at the Dash 1
we're
amendment.
At the Dash, yeah, don't bother to tell us what the bill does. What is the Dash 1 amendment?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, let's wait to get some testimony out. We'll find out.
Thank you.
You've all gotten notice that we were going to do the Dash 1 and not the bill itself today. So,
okay.
Would you call the first panel?
Yes. Actually, I think we might be able to get a chair over and get all four of them. Brian Beringer, Sarah Basler, Marianne Buffum, and Elizabeth Remley.
Which one is this? 3021.
Sorry.
Go ahead, start. You can introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Mary Beth Buffum, and I am the practice manager for Dr. Bradley Berquist, who's a neurosurgeon in Hillsboro. We're members of the Oregon Medical Association. Ours is a very small solo practice, and I do everything. I'm the chief cook and bottle washer, so I want you to keep that in mind as I tell my story about virtual credit cards. This bill increases the payment method transparency for providers and establishes clear criteria for how virtual credit card payments are made to providers. This is a new trend where providers send us a slip of paper with a credit card number and a PIN on it for our payment. It's significant because we are paying those credit card fees, which can be as high as 5%. So that reduces our reimbursement, which they're already quite low. In our case, a big chunk of our patient population is Medicare and Medicaid, so we are getting amongst the lowest reimbursements for our patients. We are not generally given advance notice of these fees, and opting out can be a real hassle. What I'm going to tell you is a bit of an outlier, but it's been an ongoing thing, and you should hear about it. I received one of these payments from Optum for a secondary claim paid by Equitable Life and Casualty. There was no phone number included to opt out, which is the usual method for opting out of these. So I looked them up on the website. I found a phone number. I called them and was told that I couldn't do this over the phone. I had to go to their website. Well, to go to their website, to get to the point where you can opt out, you have to agree to their terms and conditions, which includes language on ACH, automatic clearinghouse, electronic funds transfer, and basically says I'm agreeing to have money credited and debited from my checking account. I don't know this company. I'm not going to agree to this. So I could not move to the point where I could opt out. So I called them back, got the runaround, couldn't even get the identity of my patient, which, because we're a small practice, I could figure that out, but most practices couldn't. And I actually had to call the insurance company to confirm that information. So I called the company back again. I got a supervisor who told me that, well, once this credit card expired, after 30 days, I would be paid by check. There was no expiration date, so she gave me a date of January 30th. So then I wait. A couple of days ago, because we're 10 days past that January 30th, plus 30 days, I call them back. And they tell me, well, because it goes to paper, to a check, they don't issue the check, the insurance company does. So I call the insurance company. No, they don't do it. Optum does.
Sorry.
So, yeah. So I call Optum back, and now they give me a new payment expiration date of February 4th. It's 4 days. It's 4 days. I was told that a check should be issued March 4th. This was on Wednesday, so that was 7 days prior to the day I was talking to her. And I said, so has a check been issued? Well, no, it hasn't. But you should receive a check by March 18th. So, yeah, I feel like I'm in the middle of a Joseph Heller novel here. This is just pure craziness. So...
And Kafka novel.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, the same thing, Mr. Chair.
Sounds more like Kafka.
So I do everything in our practice. This has taken really probably about an hour and a half of my time. I'm not taking care of patients while I'm doing that. I'm not doing billing while I'm doing that. I'm not paying payables. I'm not doing our payroll. I am dealing with nonsense. And the things that concern me is this company is very well entrenched with United Healthcare, which is a huge insurer, so that makes me nervous. And while this company is an outlier, if this company can do this kind of nonsense, then anybody else can too. And so I think by adopting this amendment and making the opt-out an upfront part of it, it would save a lot of this nonsense, because I could just say I'm not going to accept these. Pay me in a timely fashion, you know, rather than 40 days later. I mean, if this was your paycheck, this would be absolutely unacceptable. So I'll get off my soapbox, but I do think it's very important, especially for small practices like ours. We can't afford this. We can't afford the 5%. We only started using credit cards about a year ago, because sometimes that's the only way we can get patient responsibility payments out of our patients. So, you know, there was a time when I didn't even have the ability to do this. So I will stop.
Well,
I've made my peace.
Our next witness is to tell us what the Dashwood Amendments actually do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Beringer with the Oregon Medical Association, and we do encourage you to move this amendment into the bill to increase payment method transparency for all of our providers here. So real quickly, the Dash 1 amendments replace the original bill, and they do four things. In page 2, line 7, they allow providers to opt in to virtual credit card payments. In page 2, line 3, they require insurers to notify providers of the fees associated with credit card payments. On page 2, line 5, they require the insurer to offer another payment method to the providers. And then in page 5, on page 5, line 22, and page 9, line 3, I'm not sure it's in there, why it's in there twice, but this is our attempt to allow a designee of the provider to work with the credit card company to opt out of these agreements. So you have our written testimony. testimony. I will call your attention to the back page of our written testimony. This was one of those issues where we started to hear about it, and then we surveyed our practices to see how big of a problem it was. And we got some great feedback, and it was a big problem. And people, in fact, when we started to look at this, people are like, absolutely, we need out of these because these are taking a lot of time, and we don't get the information.
Will you explain what this virtual credit card thing is?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a new payment method in addition to automated clearinghouse electronic funds transfers and paper check and a few other electronic non-certified electronic funds transfers that are available. That is a virtual credit card where the insurer will send the practice a Visa number, number like was explained, with a code. They input that in. And one of the things we've heard, too, is that the card will come sometimes separate from the instructions, which is difficult when you're trying to reconcile billing. But you input the code. It's like swiping the card, and then there's a fee associated with that for the processing of it. And so that's what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, if you want to use this, that's fine. Please let us know up front so that we can opt into using it. In that conversation, we want to know what the fees are. We want to know what our other options are. And we wanted to be able to designate to our staff that we can deal with these cards, because that's another issue is sometimes they'll get on the phone with the credit card company and they say, oh, we can only speak to the provider, which is a challenge in our smaller shops. So that's what we're talking about.
You're more of a challenge than in bigger places, I imagine.
Yeah. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll turn it over to Sarah.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, Sarah Baszler on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3021 with the amendments that have been described. In addition to working with registered nurses, ONA is proud to work with hundreds of nurse practitioners throughout the state through a professional association called Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. Our estimate is that there are at least 140 nurse practitioner-run clinics throughout the state, often placed in very rural and underserved areas. We did ask a number of our nurse practitioner business owners how much of an issue these virtual credit cards are, and boy, did we get an earful in response. They told us that these are increasingly common. In most cases, they just sort of show up without any prior notice that this is going to be the payment method. The fees can be very high, as you've heard. The payment method can be difficult to process and even more difficult to get out of. One clinic manager says, this is a quote, unfortunately, this is something that has become increasingly common. We do not accept these at the advice of our billing department. We are not only charged fees from the insurance company for this, but the credit card processing services as well. Every time we receive these, we have to opt out of this type of payment option. Just recently, we received one, and I called the company to request a paper check, and they informed me that I would have to wait 30 days for them to issue one. And this is the type of process that happens every time a virtual credit card arrives, which in some practices said is upwards of 15 or 20 times a week. You have in OLIS written testimony from Polly DeVore, who manages a nurse practitioner-run clinic in Enterprise. She takes you step by step through what processing these payments is like for her, so I encourage you to look closely at this. We see House Bill 3021 and its amendments as a really important way to increase transparency and reduce administrative burdens for some of these practices and give the providers and practices a choice in how they're reimbursed. So we urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today for Cambia Health Solutions. We've been working with the OMA on the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments. We're looking at that language. We may need an additional amendment. Cambia is currently phasing out paper checks, and they are moving towards ACH payments. Most large insurance companies are doing
ACH,
the direct deposit payment. It's fee-free or very, very low fees. If a provider refuses to take an ACH payment, our options are to either issue them a paper check or a virtual credit card. Our first choice, though, is to send an ACH payment, which is low or zero fees. And so what we would like to do is have this bill say, if ACH is offered and you choose not to take it, and we're phasing out paper checks, and so our other option is virtual credit cards, we don't want to pay the fees because we've given you a fee-free option. We think that the amendments get really close, if not all the way there, on doing that, so we're not very worried about it, but I wanted to get on the record that that's our goal for this bill and the compromise that we're looking for. So thank you.
Do you have a comment on that?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yes, we have talked. I see what their issue is. We need to figure out what really that default payment will be, whether it's a paper check or the virtual credit, fee-free virtual credit card. And I think that's we need to figure that out, and we'll discuss that.
You have a position on ACH payments?
We support ACH payments, absolutely, but I think our problem is that some of our smaller clinics haven't gotten there yet, and so I think what we're talking about a real small population that's moving to ACH EFT payments, but they're not there yet, and what do we do with that group? And I think that's really where we're down to on trying to sort that out.
Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenland, a quick question, and it's a small detail, but on the fees, once you get the fees posted, do those fees have a percentage maximum on it, or a lot of these insurance payments can be dollars, maybe even cents, and in theory, a provider could end up owing a dollar or something if there was a base. So how are those structured?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we've tried to survey folks, and we've also this is a trend that's happening around the country, so we got information from AMA as well. I don't know specifically to answer that question. What we've heard, though, is they've been reported as high as 5%. So, and I'm not sure if they're always there or if your threshold thing would make a difference on what the fee is, but we can check into that. But it sounds like, and I believe your situation was 4%, 4.5%, so,
I honestly don't know, but I have received checks for secondary payments at under 10 cents, so
you
make a very good point.
A 10-cent check?
Sorry. Why not? It could buy you a...
Let me just follow up.
Yes.
The concern would be you might actually have to pay to receive a 10% ACH payment or a virtual credit card payment. I don't know if that's true, but that was kind of a concern.
I just want to draw attention to this. It seems like every few years in running a medical practice, these schemes come through from some insurers, not some of the major insurers, but it's a frequent thing that small medical practices and medical practices of all kinds struggle with, and it's why the administrative overhead is so high, is because we have to deal with this over and over and over again. If you came to my practice, you'd see a whole floor of employees that just have to deal with these types of, wow, of barriers to collecting fees. It gets enormously frustrating. It's one of the reasons why we have such a high cost of medicine in this country.
Mm. Just a follow-up comment on, can I, Chair Greenlee? The follow-up comment is a lot of times our lower income people have the insurance companies that aren't in the mainstream that tend to use these products more often. And so there's a barrier, an additional barrier for the low wage or a lower premium person to get in, because then sometimes the physicians don't want to take that insurance at all. So it's an additional barrier to the low-income person.
Okay. Let us know when you get another amendment. We'll be ready to move something in, or maybe more than one something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3021 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2937. Madam Administrator, what do we got here?
Mr. Chair, 2937 defines or clarifies the definition of medical equipment and specifies criteria for coverage of medical equipment in the state medical assistance program or the Oregon Health Plan. This takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Would you call a panel?
Joseph Lowe, Leah Lotta, and Robert Palm.
Do
on. There you go. Can you get there? Yeah, you got it.
Any order, but please identify yourself when you start.
All right. I'm Joseph Lowe, so I'll go first. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. The reason that I come to you asking today for support of House Bill 2937 is recently I was in the need of a new power wheelchair, and I require a very high-end durable medical equipment device, and due to some issues with my back, I've got rods in there to support my spine from scoliosis, and so I need extra shock support, and I'm a very active member in my community. I serve on a lot of advisory councils and things like that, and so I need something that'll keep up with the pace of my day-to-day life as well. And when I went through the process of getting my doctor's prescription, the letter of medical necessity, and things like that through the therapist, I still ran into the wall that I was being denied the piece of equipment that I needed to best suit my needs. And the reason for it was I was being told two different reasons. And the first one is addressed in the bill specifically, which is the in-the-home use only phrase that Medicare actually uses. And I'm not associated with Medicare. I'm single coverage OHP. And so then I started looking more into it, and they were also telling me I was being denied because the piece of equipment I needed was on the exclusions list of Medicare as well. And so I started doing my research and found out that when the 1115 waiver was created to implement Oregon Health Plan as it is today, that it connected the way we implement Medicaid to Medicare policies. And by doing that, it's put a lot of limitations and limited access on durable medical equipment that would help people be more independent and meet their needs a lot more and keep them healthier, keep them more active in their communities, and include them into day-to-day activities with their peers. And so I started looking at the difference between a waivered Medicaid system like the state of Oregon uses and what I refer to just the regular federal Medicaid system, and those limitations does not exist. As long as we provide our doctor's prescription and therapist's letter of medical necessity, then they do the best they can to put us in that durable medical equipment. And so I just come today asking for support and trying to move that type of thinking into our current Oregon Health Plan system so that we look at in our home use, of course, but also look at all environments that we'd be using that piece of equipment. That way it gives us more community inclusion, it gives us equal opportunity at education, employment, and makes us a part of our day-to-day communities. And also, you know, at the same time, we're looking at ways of striving to provide better health and better care at lower cost these days with the new coordinated care organizations. And so spending that little bit of extra money for a high-end piece of equipment could do wonders for someone's physical and social health and be able to keep them in their homes a lot longer and out of nursing homes, make them a lot more independent. So that's and y'all have copies of my written testimony as well. That's the main piece of the focus. The amendment that will be added later on, my representative Johnson's staff member's here, so she could speak on that if anybody wants details when that will be added. But the amendments is to also disconnect from the exclusions list as well, so that that's not a backdoor way of still being denied certain pieces of durable medical equipment that people would need. And another amendment that we were looking at is possibly for people that especially have power wheelchairs, a lot of times they will own a manual wheelchair as well for a backup. If power wheelchair breaks down or anything like that, flat tires, anything, until those repairs can get made, they still obviously need a mode of mobility. And so the manual wheelchair would be the backup piece. And currently, under the system, repairs and upkeep to our backup equipment is not covered under the Oregon Health Plan. We would have to pay for that upkeep out of pocket. And that gets obviously very pricey, very expensive. And if we don't have these backup devices, we could be left stranded waiting on our primary to be repaired or even replaced if we're needing a new piece of equipment. And
what eventually happened in your case?
Chair Greenlick, in my case, I went through a year and a half battle. I'd done a hearing, an appeals hearing process, was totally denied in that piece as well. But I kept pushing, kept fighting, and I actually ended up winning the battle. I'm actually sitting in the chair today that I fought for. During that year and a half, they put me in a loaner wheelchair, which was the same level of equipment that the current Medicaid system for the state of Oregon would pay for, and I ended up sustaining permanent damage to my lower back. And so it's been medically documented and things like that, so it's proof that if we're not in proper equipment, we can sustain different health issues. A lot of times, especially in power wheelchairs, the vibration of the ride can cause internal issues with your organs. It can also cause blurred vision from all the extra vibrations. And so the high-end pieces of equipment kind of cushions that ride and can protect you from that. So I had to push really hard and fought for a long time, but I finally won that case. But my intent by trying to get this bill supported is so that no other person would have to go through the experience that I did. I know there's a lot of people out there that maybe doesn't have the ability or the knowledge to be able to know how to fight the system and get their needs met. And so I'm thinking of, you know, others and trying to protect them by getting this bill passed.
And are you proposing that we give up the 1115 waiver or that we handle this as a separate matter?
No. Chair Greenlick, I would never ask to give up the 1115 waiver. It would just be a disconnect from the Medicare connection on these two policies from Medicare.
Specific
yeah.
issues.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Who's next, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Pung, and I'm a member of Elders in Action Commission. The Elders in Action Commission is a senior advocacy council that advises the City of Portland, Multnomah County, and Multnomah County Aging and Disability Services and Veteran Services on issues affecting older adults in Multnomah County. As such, we support affordable, high-quality health care, housing, nutrition, transportation services for older adults and adults with disabilities. The Elders in Action Commission supports the passage of House Bill 2937, modifying the rules for determining the type of and extent of medical equipment paid for by the state medical assistance program for people with physical or developmental disabilities. The bill will allow low-income individuals who are reliant on wheelchairs and scooters for their mobility to acquire high-quality equipment that provides them with flexibility and independence. My wife, Maureen, and I both rely solely on wheelchairs for our mobility. Without this equipment, we cannot get around. We remain very active in our community and in Elders in Action Commission, but without high-quality equipment at a reasonable price, we would be bound at home and not be able to go in our community and do the work we choose. Wheelchairs are made for our home use only. We would only be able to travel to and from the MAX and to stations to attend meetings that require us to travel some distance along sidewalks. They're our only form of mobility, and they need to be made well and able to function outside our homes. We urge you to pass this important piece of legislation. Thank you. And I'd like to also wish Chairman Greenlick a belated happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I'm clearly a target member for Elders in Action. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
my name is Eliza Swafford. Thank you for having me here. I have cerebral palsy. I've had it for, I'm not going to tell you, since birth. Several years ago, I was given a scooter through Medicare, and it helped me get around town and be active in my daughter's life. That was 15 years ago. And she greatly enjoyed having me at her activities. When my old one died, I tried to get a new one, but with this phrase, in-home use, it prohibited me from doing so. I can walk in my house. That should be valued. However, with this written the way it is, it prevents me from having a scooter to get out and about and live my life. So there are many people like me that could greatly use this bill to be put forward by just removing that phrase. You can open doors for thousands. Thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much for testifying. I really appreciate the extraordinary effort it must be for you to join us. We love having citizens testify.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have another panel?
We do, Mr. Chair.
I was on that one. I haven't been.
We'll bring you back with the next two. Can you stay there?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Traffic jam.
I know. Ooh. But they do good. Lila Swafford, Bob Jundeff, John Mullen. Oh, okay. We'll bring the other chair.
Oh, yeah, I pushed it out of the way. Hi, I'm Leah Latta. I am a physical therapist working for Partnerships in Community Living, a nonprofit organization that provides homes for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So as part of my job, it is to, I go out to the homes and evaluate individuals and assess their needs, including durable medical equipment is a huge piece. I really sympathize with the individuals that were just up here because I see it firsthand every day where you have someone who is ambulatory in the home and wants to stay ambulatory in their home because they value that independence but cannot get out of the house because once you add in inclines and different levels in the ground, all of a sudden they are not independent. They cannot walk. But insurance, when you have that in-home little piece, it doesn't matter what they do outside of the home. They don't take that into consideration at all. So I often get house managers that say, We really want to take Susie Q to the church function, but she can't walk into the church from the end to the front of the pew where she wants to sit. And I say, Anna, I'm so sorry. They don't care what she does outside. She doesn't care. They don't care how involved she is with her community. So I often look like the bad guy because I'm the one that's saying, it doesn't matter. And then they kind of, well, so do we need to keep her confined to a chair in her home so that we can justify a wheelchair? And I, as a therapist, no, we want them walking. We want them independent. It's something we're going to have to work around. We're going to have to find ways. We get a lot of donations that we try and haggle together for people. And also I wanted to bring up, there was a recent bill passed mandating employment, a path to employment for individuals that have, for community employment for individuals with disabilities. And a lot of times, some of the piece that is preventing them from getting community employment is mobility. And so when you deny them the mobility, but then say they're supposed to have this path, they're often at odds, and it becomes a huge problem. And our lives don't live in our home. If all you did was stay in your home all day, it might as well be a prison. We want these people to get out and be involved and be independent. And I have individuals that could be independent in a wheelchair in the community, but can't get a wheelchair because of this clause. And then you have it at different levels. So you have the people who can walk in the home, but can't walk in the community. You have the people that have a manual wheelchair in their home, but the manual wheelchair, to push that manual wheelchair is very hard on your shoulders for any distance. So if you have someone who is fragile, who can push that chair around their home, but can't push it in the community, then they don't qualify for an electric chair, and then you get into the cost of a very expensive chair. And I would like to think that we value someone's quality of life so that we can get them independent and happy and part of our being a more valued and productive member of our community, which a lot of them have that ability.
I had an experience with somebody, remember, I fell and knocked the quadriceps off both my knees and had double knee surgery and did things like coming down in an ambulance to vote on the opening day to organize the house. But I arranged a very complicated and expensive way of being at the legislature on an ongoing basis with, had a hotel suite and made a hospital room out of one of them and had wheelchair transit all the time. And I asked for some home health help in that process, which I thought I ought to be able to get. And I was told because I had arranged things that I was coming to work, I no longer qualified for care because I wasn't in the home. I said, well, I would have been forced to be in the home if I did, if I hadn't made several hundred dollars a month worth of accommodations to it, and I just asked for a little bit of care. No, I wasn't homebound by definition since I wasn't homebound anymore and couldn't get help. I mean, it's the same kind of...
It is.
That homebound stuff is a complicated issue. Who's next? I should have got you to help me, Bob.
I would have helped. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. First of all, I just want to thank Joseph Lowe for all the work that he did on this bill. I think this bill represents the best in terms of a citizen taking it upon himself to bring a very important issue to the legislature. I'll just give a little background to talk about maybe why I think that. Back in the end of the 1990s, there was a revolution in thinking about how we should be using our federal and state resources to help people with disabilities, and by help them, it was help them to be as engaged in their communities, to be as a vital part of society as possible, which means working, going to school, going to the store for yourself, engaging in all the aspects of life that one can. And at that time, on the federal level, there was an act passed to provide resources for augmented assistive technology services and devices, and for advocacy to help people get those devices. And there was a program that was created specifically for our organization and organizations like ours across the country that to advocate for people to get needed assistive technology devices. And those go beyond wheelchairs all the way to computer equipment and very simple devices that can help a person be able to function as well as anybody else in society and to lead a fuller life. And at the same time, there were new programs put into place by the Social Security Administration to encourage people to go back to work who were on Social Security, because there was a recognition that, unlike the older thinking, that once you were determined to have a disability, basically your life in society was over and you had to go to your apartment or house and just stay there, that in fact people could be productive. And so the work incentives programs were put into place to encourage people to go back to work and to help them with the resources that they need in order to do that without risking falling off a cliff and losing all of their benefits, but actually help them to have the supports. As was just pointed out, if you want to go back to work and earn the money that you need to buy an electric wheelchair, under the present rules, of course, you have to get to that job and start working in order to have the resources to do that. You're not going to be able to use public benefits to get you what you need in order to be more productive. And that's why this particular bill is so important. And the fact that it's taken us over 15 years from what I'm talking about to get there speaks, I think, to the fact that technology has advanced so greatly over those years that we can do so much more now to help people be more productive. And really the time has come to recognize that we have to, in order to make a dent in the fact that the unemployment rate for people with disabilities is twice as high as it is for the rest of the society, to start to think about how we want to be more inclusive of people with disabilities and not say that staying in your home is fine. We'll provide someone to go shop for you. We'll provide someone to get you the things that you need, while basically giving up on those folks in terms of being an active member of society. I give all that background to explain to you why we're here to support this legislation, that we think it is extremely important, and it would be a major step forward for many people who really want to participate. They want to come to the legislature to testify. They want to work. They want to be more engaged in their communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. Well, you've heard some compelling testimony from consumers and the provider perspective, and then Bob gave a really good grounding in the historical aspect of why we're here and in this particular situation. At times, it seems like the federal government has a left-hand and right-hand approach to things, and despite the court rulings and the emphasis on home and community-based services, we have this obstacle in Medicare law about the homebound situation. So I think that decoupling from Medicare makes lots of sense. The main reason I wanted to testify is that I've known Joseph now for a number of years, and we brainstormed a bit about his own personal situation, and I gave him some encouragement and a couple of ideas. But he took it upon himself to take care of his particular situation. He did a really terrific job with advocating for himself. What's so compelling to me is that he then took it upon himself to work on this issue for other people. So that I hope you will give strong consideration to this bill. I just think it's a really terrific example of citizen advocacy coming to you here at the legislature. Thank you.
I'm going to call an OHA witness to talk about this, but perhaps I'm curious about what the implications of uncoupling from Medicare on these components of the program. I mean, how does that affect our waiver generally? Would that require unmatched general funds to do these things? Could you, or should we wait till OHA comes up? Bob, you may have some.
Mr. Chair, I don't have comments on that.
Okay, great. Tom, good. Are there questions to this panel? Thank you. Do we have another panel?
No, that's it. I'm going to call Brian.
Brian Newberg, can you join us? He was warned that we were going to drag him up here. And when, before we're done, we want to go back into a work session and give Representative Clem a chance to vote on the bill we moved on. Brian, did you hear my question?
Chair Greenlee, member of this committee, Brian Ebert, health legislative coordinator for healthcare programs with the Oregon Health Authority. So, your question being, does this put us at risk for?
Well, can we disengage from Medicare on the homebound piece for DME, and if so, what are the consequences of that? How does it affect our waiver generally?
I think the bill as currently written presents some risk that we would have some general fund obligation. I think the other thing for consideration is that CMS is actually in the process of reconsidering their federal Medicaid requirements that include a lot of the verbiage that's in this language. And I'm happy to provide those links. They're going through their rulemaking process right now, and we've been in discussions with them. Our DME representatives within OHP have been actively engaging them to see where those discussions may go. Obviously, they're still in the process, and with CMS, it's anybody's guess when they may be finalized. But I think a lot of the issues that are being discussed in respect to this bill are also being considered at the federal level.
Could we bring your folks in who have been working on this to give us a little further explanation of that?
Yes, and I'm happy to provide the information that's publicly available through CMS as well, so you have that. But we can certainly bring some of our policy experts who have had those discussions.
And if we bring this bill to a work session, do you have any idea what the fiscal piece is going to look like?
Well, you know, the bill as currently written, sorry, Representative Chair Greenlee, the bill as currently written requires us to write rules, and one of those rules is to provide a definition of normal activities. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact language memorized. So the fiscal piece would be dependent on how that rulemaking process played out and what that definition looked like.
We'd have an indeterminate fiscal.
We'd have an indeterminate. We've done some. We've done a little bit of guesswork about. I think obviously there would be an increase in some utilization, and we've done some. Some, 10% increase, 20% increase number guessing, but where that would land would largely depend on how that rulemaking process and what that final definition looked like. A lot of this work, parallel work, is already going on at the federal level, and obviously we would.
It'd be the easiest way.
Chair Green, I think we would like to see how that plays out, but we would leave the ultimate decision up to you about whether to wait or to pursue something on the state level.
Well, I'd love to have some testimony from your folks that are working on that, the extent to which they can deal with what's public. But
okay,
I think our basic principle is, and I suspect OHA's principle as well, that we want to maximize the ability of every Oregonian to function at the highest level they can possibly function. And the last thing we want is to put barriers in front of our ability to maximize individuals' functioning ability. Chair, thank you for coming Chair up Greenland, unawares. I appreciate that.
I think you've stated our opinion, our stances perfectly as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions or comments? I'll close the work session on House Bill. On House Bill 2937. Mm-hmm. And could we ask for a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Clem to vote on House Bill 2110? Somebody?
Oh, yes. I move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Klein to vote on 2110.
Hearing no objection. Representative Klein, that's a bill to move House Bill 2110 to another committee.
That's exciting. Aye.
Paid attention to that one.
Anything else to be brought before the committee? Look at what time it is.
Yes, we have 21:25, sir.
What do we have? Yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to open up a work session for the purpose of invited testimony on 21:25. We are under some instruction to make sure we just don't pass these bills on to another committee to deal with, but to bring our own public policy perspective on the effect of these bills. I think 2125 is the perfect example of that. The other committees, the Joint Tax Committee and the Revenue Committee both, are asking us to think about these bills, answer some questions, and we pass out some questions for ourselves to think about and to spend a little time. So I've asked the advocates to, I'm not sure you're advocates, but the experts to come and testify to add a little more information to us on the question of 2125 and how the program's working. We've been asking such things as, what's the 50% time piece of that work? What really is a rural area? How close are we coming to meeting the objectives of the bill that makes some sense? Scott, can I ask you, are you going to join us as well? And anybody else that would like to testify? Let me know. Great. Scott, thank you very much for coming back.
You're welcome.
Chair Greenlee. Did some of this, but I hope you can help us with a little further. Thank you for reminding me. I was going to get everybody out here too early. Can't do that.
Chair Greenlee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. I brought some materials to help answer the questions that I was given in advance.
I really appreciate that.
One is a map of the state and what areas are considered rural, what are considered urban. If that would be helpful, I'm happy to. Okay. With that, would you like me to go through the questions that I was given?
Or I think anything you'd be willing to give us that provide, that helps us have a little insight into what's happening would be very helpful.
Okay. So the first question is, what is the public policy purpose of this credit, and is there an expected timeline for achieving the goal? There's no stated public policy purpose in the law, of course, and it did pass into law prior to my joining the Office of Rural Health, but I think presumably we can assume the purpose was simply
pretty straightforward.
Increase the number of providers in rural Oregon. There was not necessarily any timeline for achieving the goal. In prior testimony, I've given you a graph of the number of providers that can qualify for the credit and how that's increased over the years. At the same time, the ratio of providers to population is still greatly reduced compared to urban Oregon. The second question, directly benefits from the credit. That would be the eligible professions that get the tax credit. Indirectly, of course, the people that they care for in their practices. That's physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, dentists.
Can we go back to the first question for a moment?
Certainly.
Is it pretty fair to say that we would have fewer professionals than practicing in the rural areas if it weren't for these programs? And I think we can talk generally both about the loan repayment and the tax credit question. I mean, would, as we ask people in the rural areas, would they be pretty convinced that this is making a difference?
Chair Greenlick, I believe strongly that we would see a reduction of providers in rural communities, and that's not just my personal gut level feeling. That is the response that we get, and truly the quite the vocal reaction we get whenever we bring up the issue to people who currently receive the credit. I think that they value the credit more in terms of a retention tool than a recruitment tool. I don't think $5,000 necessarily plays a real heavy role in their decision to locate to a rural community, but I think it does play a role in their decision to stay, whereas loan repayment, of course, is much more a recruitment tool. That's a short-term benefit that's received, relatively speaking.
You have a rural health advisory committee, is that right?
Yes, Chair Green, we do.
Could you ask them to make a statement for this committee on what their perspective of this is?
Absolutely, be happy to.
That would be very useful, I think, for us.
The next question, what's expected to happen if this credit fully sunsets? First of all, those who currently receive the tax credit would get it for another 10 years. And the reason for that is that we didn't want to see a precipitous drop in the number of people serving rural Oregonians. If the tax credit were to cease, if the sunset were allowed to take effect, I think the primary impact that we would see is that it would no longer be able to be used as a recruitment tool when someone's trying to recruit a provider to their community, be it a hospital or a practice or what have you, and they lay out the various options for their community, for rural practice. This is one of them. It's a rather unique one. There aren't a whole lot of states that have a tax credit for this purpose, and I think that it is very appealing to a lot of people. Could the adequate results be achieved with a scaled-down version of the credit? I think that the effectiveness of the program would be scaled down in the same amount. What would be the effect of reducing the credit by 50%? You could do that in a couple different ways. You could make the credit worth $2,500 instead of $5,000, or you could change the eligibility criteria so that only half the people qualified. But again, I think that you would see a subsequent reduction in the effect of the program as well. What background information on the effectiveness of this type of credit is available from other states? As I said, there are very few. I don't personally have any information about the track record in other states or any sort of evaluation that they've done. I know that my colleagues in the state of New Mexico worked with our office directly. They were so intrigued with the law, they pretty much took a copy of the law to their legislature and got it passed as well in New Mexico. Is use of a tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve this policy goal? I would simply answer that by saying distribution of healthcare providers between urban and rural is truly a complex issue, and there is no one answer or quote-unquote silver bullet to solving the problem of distribution of providers. I think it's helpful. I think it's just one tool, but I certainly think it's very helpful. There's no one program that's going to achieve the policy goal of evening out the distribution of providers between urban and rural. What are the administrative and compliance costs associated with this credit? It costs each tax credit recipient a $45 processing fee each year that they get the credit. So there's no cost to the state, no direct cost to the Office of Rural Health. Would a direct appropriation achieve the goal of this credit more efficiently? And I've pondered that question. I don't know what a direct appropriation would do. I would just have to say no. What are the other incentives are available that attempt to achieve a similar policy goal? Chair Greenlich, you mentioned loan repayment. There's a couple different loan repayment programs in the state. One is a state federal match. One is a federal match program where we require that the 50% match come from the practice site. We apply for the federal grant, get the other 50% from the practice site. There is the Medicaid Primary Care Loan Repayment Program, which is strictly state-funded. There are some strictly federally funded loan repayment programs. There is a strictly state-funded loan forgiveness program. There's a scholarship program for the various schools at Oregon Health and Science University. There's a medical malpractice subsidy program. They all, of course, have the same general goal, that is to either attract or keep providers in rural communities by trying to assist with the financial burden of either loans or medical malpractice or the pay differential that many rural providers experience practicing in a rural community. And could this credit be modified to make it more effective and or more efficient? I would simply say that you could ask that question and I could give you my gut level response. I think that the time has come to really do a serious evaluation of all our incentive programs. That's not something that can be done internally. I don't think that that's a very effective way to go about it. There is a bill on the Senate side, Senate Bill 757, that requests support for Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and Oregon Center for Nursing to do a longitudinal evaluation, a deep dive evaluation and then a longitudinal process thereafter so that we can come back to you every biennium with much more informed responses to what works for what purpose, where's the biggest bang for the buck, what might have worked 10 years ago but doesn't work today, what's a new idea that might work and be better to replace some of the programs that are currently out there. There are other bills out there regarding this tax credit program. There's one that's just been introduced in the House, I think it's 3245, that attempts to make the program at least more understandable, if not more efficient, in that it pretty much levels the playing field for all the various professions and specialties that can take advantage of this program as it stands now. If you're a physician, the eligibility criteria is very different than if you are a dentist. And if you are a CRNA, it's different than if you are a different professional. It wipes out all those qualifying eligibility criteria and just says, not only, it does two things, not only if you're in a rural underserved community, but also if you're an urban underserved community. So that bill also adds urban providers to this tax credit. Those are attempts that are being made, again, without evaluation results to really drive those sorts of decisions, but it certainly would make it easier to understand.
Scott, can I ask you a question? We have a map that you've given us on the total number of people getting tax credits. How many of the total people on that chart?
There's just shy of 2,100, I believe, in tax year 2013. I think the tables you have in front of you, one of them is from 2013. Yeah, I think it's 2000.
I don't see 2,000 on this page.
Oh, 2,076 on the colored
map. No, I see
the
number. I just don't see when you add them up that it looks like that many.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, if you take the big numbers.
Certainly should.
Well, I look at.
You want me to start
the biggest
that?
Number around Ashland, Grants Pass, Florence,
Baker City,
Newport, Lincoln City. I mean, I get about 250 or 300 in those alone. I don't see where the other big ones come from.
There.
It is.
You start adding. There's 100 here.
The question is. I'll get to it. Well, I mean, it really does matter whether it's 2,000. It looks like the place that has the biggest numbers are places like Ashland and Newport and Florence and Tillamook.
The Dalles, Hood River, Ontario.
That's about the big numbers. That's maybe 300. How many in Ontario? Pendleton's got 70. People really wonder whether the Oregon coast is rural in the context of here.
Chair Greenlick, they should live there and try to access health care.
Yes. Pardon me?
I said, Chair Greenlick, they should live there and try to access health care, and then I think they'd understand.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of friends who live in Tillamook, in that area, and they're about 45 minutes away. Is that the definition? Is that what we're talking about, rural, when you're...
The other map that you got should...
That at 10 miles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This map defines mm-hmm. what is rural. So everything on the coast is currently defined as rural by our office.
Okay. Is there some distribution I've seen in the past, I haven't seen it lately, of the specialties that have been covered by this, extent to which this is primary care versus other things? You had some change in rules recently, right? A couple of years.
Chair Greenlick, there was a change in the law around medical malpractice subsidy as to which specialties of physicians could benefit from that program, but not for tax credit.
Others of you have questions?
Yeah,
please go ahead.
Go ahead, you can go first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Nose is next.
It's more of a comment, Mr. Chair. I am struggling with this because at one level, I think, you know, there probably is some disparity in terms of access to providers in rural parts of Oregon, and I think we want to encourage a distribution of providers across the state. At least I do. I'm intrigued by the idea of a study, though frankly, I'm not convinced that a study will tell us anything.
I mean,
I could say better roads and investment in economic development and make certain parts of rural communities more attractive, and that will draw people in, and it has nothing to do with the tax credit. It just means communities are as charming as Ashland and Hood River seem to be at the moment relative to other, you know, so I don't know. Like, I'm not sure a study is going to tell us anything more conclusive in 2 years about, you know, like, what makes someone move to Bend or LeGrand or Ontario is, I think, pretty hard to capture.
I agree.
So I can't, you know, I can't figure out what to do. I'm torn, to be honest with you.
Well, these things are significant investments. Now, that's not to say we don't make other investments with a lot less data than we have here.
Well, that's a good model.
Unfortunately true.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi. Well, thank you. And probably not surprising to you, I have strong opinions about this, among other things. I strongly support the idea of a rural credit. I also really strongly support the idea of a study that's the Senate bill coming over. Because I think what's really important is that, I think Hood River can be very appealing. There's a lot that right now is going to Grants Pass. I think what's really important is to figure out what the workforce gaps are among the different professions, MDs, dentists, nurse practitioners. I don't know if certified nurse midwives are considered in the nurse practitioner category. But just looking at all the different professions and, you know, coming up with a distribution that is aligned with where the workforce gaps are is really important. So that would be one thing that I'm very, very supportive of that Senate bill coming over. It tempts me to want to put a 2-year sunset or maybe a 4-year if you needed more time to do that kind of study and help it inform what other professions we should be looking at. I know that even if we extend it for 6 years, we can always come back and do that ahead of time, so that would not... I would still vote for this, but I do think that compelling us to look at it again sooner rather than later, as soon as we can get the data, is a good thing. I'm concerned about the 20 hours, so I would want to look at, you know, do you say in areas that have 75%, you get a partial credit for 20 hours, you get more for 30 hours, you get the full credit. So that would be another fine-tuned way to look at it. And then the other thing is, I think it's really important that I'm assuming it sunsets in 6 years, but it's a credit that will last for 10 years. You're letting them know that they'll have that for 10 years. That the people that get the loan repayment and are mandated because of the loan forgiveness program to be there already for 3 years, that should come out of the decade. I mean, that would really be silly to give them a tax credit at a time where they have to be there in order to get their loan. And they're already getting a significant investment from the state. So that, to me, is really important. Even now, I would like to see an amendment on that this time around. So those are just some of the ways that I think it could be fine-tuned.
Chair Greenlink, I believe you had a question about the halftime aspect as well. I'm happy to answer any questions about that.
Mr. Boringer, can I get you up here? Doug, did you have some comments? I mean, we've got a couple of bills now to add occupational therapists. We have a bill to add pharmacists to it. I don't know what criteria we use to think about that. I mean, we need pharmacists out there. Maybe we need occupational therapists out there. Does the OMA have a position on this? Can they give us some policy insight that would help us?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I walked in and I missed the exact question I'm addressing. But
you have no notice.
No, it's okay.
We're trying to figure out what the policy basis is for extending both tax credits and loan repayment.
Yes.
How we decide this bill versus some other bill.
So, Mr. Chair, I think I've talked to a number of you individually about this. We think there are opportunities to make some changes in this and other programs. And we also think that there are some of the things that are floating around, like some of the selective pooling and stuff or eligibility, you know, matching up that makes sense that you can do right now. I think there's also an opportunity to do some other things, but we would encourage everybody to get that data so that we're doing the right things. So, and for example, with the rural health tax credit, if we could look at I think we can all look out there and see communities where we need more and where we'd like to adjust it up in some high need areas. But given the state's revenue situation, you know, we would need to take that from other parts of the program. And what I can't tell you, I don't think we can tell you right now, is where the best place is to take to make the other side. And so that's what we were hoping in Senate Bill 757 could be done in the, you know, in the research project to collect that data so that you could be strategic in how we address these shortages from community to community, instead of what we have right now is distance to population and size of population, which is not the most perfect levers to pull on this.
Is it looking like that bill's coming over?
The bill currently doesn't, Mr. Chair, the bill currently does not have a Ways and Means reference on it. I think it needs one because of the funding side of it. So I'm guessing that it would go to the policy committee and then down to Ways and Means. But that doesn't preclude us to, once you get time in your schedule, for us to come in and present on it. And I think more importantly, what you want to know is what the OE, the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and OCN would do with that money and what kind of data they could produce for you. And that, I think you could do at any time in your schedule.
Yeah. Representative Knows, Representative Bueller, we're particularly happy to have your view on this.
Mr. Chair, can we do an amendment that says certain areas of the state that seem to be saturated with people who are getting this no longer qualify for it, especially since it goes out for 10 years? You know, maybe it's achieved its goal in the Dalles and Hood River and Grants Pass, but maybe Christmas Valley, John Day, you know, maybe they need more there. I don't know, you know.
On the tax credit, anybody who's in the class can apply, is that right? Is that the tax credit piece? Yeah, that's not the loan repayment.
Sure. Chair Green, yeah, that's true. If they meet the minimum criteria of seeing a certain amount of Medicare and Medicaid and they're practicing there at least half-time, they can apply.
Ten more show up in Ashland then.
Correct.
Follow-up? So then do we, if I want to get at that, I'm not sure I do, I'm thinking out loud here.
I think that's a good idea.
Thank you.
Seriously, I think we need to discuss this and get some...
Because I guess, you know, I thought Representative Kenny Geyer is on something about 20 hours. Maybe we don't do that because we want to incent people to actually live in these areas, because my anecdotal evidence is that a lot of people who are doing the 20-hour thing are sort of commuting from more urban areas to go out to those areas to get the credit. Now, the flip side of that, I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth, is if we don't offer it, then those folks won't go out there potentially to do that at all, and then this chart looks worse. So
Yeah, I can imagine somebody going out two full days a week or something like that from Ben to John Day. And if
or
you
Ben
take
to
this
Sisters.
Away,
Ben to Sisters.
Well, they don't have to leave Bend underneath this. Well, you mentioned Christmas Valley. It appears that 50% of the population in Christmas Valley are providers.
And providers.
Two
I was thinking the same thing.
Representative Bueller, will you weigh in on this one, please?
Well, considering I'm a provider living in Bend who goes out to John Day, but not frequently enough to qualify for any tax credit, so I'm not conflicted here. But I do think it would be helpful to have a gap analysis of workforce needs with regards to all healthcare occupations in rural areas. And I think Representative Nose has a good point. It's going to be hard to prove if the tax credit incentivizes someone, but I think it will not be hard to prove if there's a gap in appropriate workforce in these areas, be it physicians or nurse practitioners or pharmacists or occupational therapists. And I think that's what I'd like to see that money used for, to do a gap analysis in terms of occupational needs. And in the interim, I think we should look at approving it for a shorter duration so that we can have that data to make a good decision next time around.
We had a little attempt to try and find out an occupational therapist. Is that right, Doug? Do you want to talk a little about that? We did try and find out whether there was a big shortage.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Rural Health Association. The occupational therapist bill had to do with loan repayment program. The pharmacist's bill, there was I forget the number, I think it's on the agenda today, was for the rural health tax credit. And there was some work done on trying to find out how many pharmacists would qualify. And the last number I saw was close to 800. So if that's accurate, that would be
800 pharmacists who could get credit or who would currently
who would qualify based on the geographic eligibility
where they live right now.
Yeah. And which would be about a $2.5 to $3 million a year impact.
And wouldn't change the supply of pharmacists anywhere.
Right, that's baseline.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bill that you passed, is that last session or the session before, dealing with critical access pharmacies? And so there may be, and there's a map that shows where they're located, there may be a way to structure the bill so that those areas that have the highest need for pharmacies and are having the hardest time finding them might be able to work around that.
We're going to get proposals to move pharmacists into both programs, I think. Yeah. We're not done with that yet. Is that right? Did I hear?
Yes.
I think we have amendments to bills that would attempt to move pharmacists both into the loan repayment and the
tax credit.
The tax credit.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
You can ask anything you want.
If
this is open discussion.
Thank you. If we approve of sunset and somebody has a 10-year credit, and then we change something 5 years down the line. Can we close off that credit, or is it kind of like a contract, and they are eligible for that for 10 years?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Ken Geyer, as I understand it, you could change the law at any time, and it would negate what was on the books prior.
And Chair Gerling, Representative Kenny Geyer, we did make two changes in the law last session,
mm-hmm.
the one dealing with the 20 hours as opposed to 60% of your practice,
mm-hmm.
and the other one had to do with seeing, making sure that they saw or had their practice open to Medicaid and Medicare. And both of those, I mean, part of it was done to reduce the number of people who were taking the credit. I mean, they were small, but they were both,
right.
That was the target. And so even though the credit as a whole has this tail on it, that 10-year tail, if you change the law, then people can lose that eligibility immediately whenever the bill is enacted.
So follow up, I know Scott, you had talked about being willing to answer the question about 20 hours, I'm still curious about should we prorate a credit for 20 hours versus 30 versus 40? And then is there a minimum number of OHP Medicare that should be seen in order to qualify?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, regarding the halftime requirement, as Doug mentioned, that replaced the prior language which said 60% of your practice. Well, there's a certain number of people who are in partial retirement and their practice is maybe 10 hours a week already. And so that the change to half-time, half-FTE sort of orientation was done to further restrict and make sure that you are actually providing services half the week rather than 60% of your practice, because how your practice is defined differs greatly from one to another. I just have to add that there are a number of communities that don't have enough population to support a full-time mm-hmm. provider or two providers, and so you need one and a half. I know of one community that the only way, it's a physician that operates a clinic and needs PAs or NPs to work with him. The only way he could recruit was to offer for them to work a full week and then have a full week off, and then they would go back to whatever community they lived in, but they would live temporarily in the community where they were working at the clinic for a week, and that was a working arrangement that works very well for him. He's able to recruit using that sort of model. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of insight to the 50% requirement. Mm-hmm. I guess you could certainly tier the credit according to the number of hours you work. I can guarantee you we will hear from people who say you're penalizing me and I thought I was doing you a favor by traveling out to this community and practicing my 20 hours a week or what have you. So,
and then follow up.
Let's have one for Representative Lively and then come right back.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So as I listen to this conversation, there's a couple of things. First, I think what Representative Buehler said is critically important to have kind of the base and what it is, because I think I'm still confused of what the policy issue is here.
That's without, what we're trying to figure out.
I know. And without defining that, it's harder for me. But the second part of this is I look at the map and I've listened to some of this other conversation. This is a prime example of so much we do here that one model doesn't fit all. So there are different reasons in some of those rural communities about how a physician might be available or not. And so trying to apply it across the state as we have, that's why we see these larger numbers in some cases of those areas that may not have as difficult as time. And so from my standpoint, it kind of goes back to that policy discussion. What's the real policy here? And then again, what is the gap? So what are the real issues? And then we can, without those, I don't think we never agree on what the policy should be and how we address it.
Yeah, I might argue that we move ahead with a relatively new sunset and don't add anything else to it in the interim until we have a way to figure this out. So you have Representative Kenny Geyer.
Just a quick question. Is there a mandatory minimum percentage to serve OHP and Medicare? Or is it just that you have to be open to that, whatever that means?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, you must remain open.
So you say you're open, but you can say we have an appointment available in 3 months?
I suppose you could, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
That might be better than not having anybody. Representative Knowles?
Maybe it's better to eliminate this and then just make an appropriation, say, here's our gap analysis, and we want X number of nurse practitioners and X number of surgeons and X number of nurse anesthetists here, and we're just going to, like a scholarship, just give it to you and do it that way. And then we know we're paying for it outright and we're incentivizing the right thing, as opposed to something that feels kind of random to me. So now maybe I'm in favor of the study.
You mean you weren't 10 minutes ago?
Which side of the mouth was that?
Well, I really do. Thank you. And somebody else?
Yes.
Oh, sure. You've been quiet.
Yeah. So thank you, Chair Greenlick. So I've actually practiced in a lot of these locations, Heppner, Boardman, Pendleton, John Day, Primeville Sisters.
Do you need to declare conflict of interest?
Chiloquin, Klamath Falls. And I can tell you that the providers out there that are going out there, many of these places struggle mightily to keep a brick-and-mortar clinic justified in order to have a practice, and they are going out there part-time. It's mandatory to have the part-time thing out of the goodness of their heart. They're not getting rich off of this. And any $5,000 offset against their taxes is not enough to convince them to do that. They are doing this because they want to help rural Oregon. Now, you might make an argument around if the intent is rural Oregon, that in Grants Pass, and so I'd be interested to see this map 2 years ago before they started to do the underserved and Medicaid areas, but that in as of itself was to gear up for the Affordable Care Act to come into place to make sure that they had enough providers in that area too. So I think it's absolutely critical that we keep it until we have the appropriate amount of information in place to change it, because these people on this side of the map, which is about 700 or 800 of them, they are not getting wealthy off of this. This is not a, you know, just a cash incentive for them to be out there. They're out there because it's a lifestyle and it's a commitment to the people out there. Over here, you might have some questions of whether that's appropriate or not. And if the focus is to have more service for Medicare or Medicaid providers, then I would say it's appropriate. I think it's underfunded.
Anybody else? Well, I would really ask the committee to really think about this. I mean, because we have been charged with at least taking a policy stand, and the policy stand might be we don't know one way or the other. We need some study and keep the program as it is in the meantime until we figure it out, or it could be something else. It could be not any new people. I'm a little alarmed by what you said about 800. Did you say 800 pharmacists that would instantly qualify for it? That's going to make me a little slow to move on that one. But we have been asked, and I think it's reasonable to make sure we're thinking about it from a policy perspective and not just, it sounds all right, pass it on to somebody else, although if that's what we end up doing, that's what we'll do. Yes?
Okay, just one last clarifying question. If that Senate bill passes, do you think that you'll have enough data in 2 years that we would be able to...
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for asking that question. If we are doing a comprehensive look at all the different incentive programs, we'll probably have enough information about this particular tax credit program in 2 years. But if we're doing a comprehensive look, the scholarship programs, the loan forgiveness programs are all relatively new. And so we won't have people back in the field practicing as they were intended for more years than that, let's put it that way. If we're looking at loan repayment, for example, or loan forgiveness, we'll have some physician assistants and nurse practitioners in the field, but not necessarily physicians. They, of course, need to finish medical school and then go off to at least a 3-year residency program before they come back. So we'll have partial results. This particular tax credit, to get back on the regular health tax credit cycle of sunsets, would be 4 years. It was given a 2-year extension in the 2013 session, so we're a bit off cycle with the rest of the health tax credits.
Well, and I heard something like all of the sunsetted tax credits, the current ones, and I'm not sure it included this, were worth something like, I remember the number, 85 or 90 million. And that the current budget had something like 14 million for it.
64 total.
So, I mean, that puts this bunch in a tough competition if we really stick to the 14, which it doesn't seem to me that would be.
May I make one clarifying comment?
Not only that, I would love your clarifying comments, but I'd like the three of you or anybody else who has some insight that they want to put into this conversation to please make it available to the committee. And I would say as fast as you possibly can. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I have to be honest, I haven't looked very closely at the bill that would add pharmacists to the program. There's a number of different ways that you could write up the eligibility criteria. That's why for each profession that's in the program, there's different eligibility criteria. It depends on the budget you're working with that year. They weren't all, you know, they've been added over the years. It started with physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and the other professions were added over the years, and the conditions were different during different years. For pharmacists, you could certainly entertain eligibility criteria that would cut that number down. We're simply saying that there's roughly 800, depending on what database you look at, that are currently in rural Oregon as we define it.
Buying the grand story.
Sam Bueller.
How long would it take to do a gap analysis of health occupation needs in rural Oregon?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, that's not my area of expertise. I'm not so sure I could say that, but I would think we would be able to come back for the 2017 session, certainly very well informed.
Survey data.
It's a matter of figuring out what is the ideal number.
What's the baseline you guys are supposed to have?
What is the ideal mix? Like, you know, about 2,000 people per family physician is what the industry has currently has used in the past anyway, 2,500 maybe. I don't know what that is for physical therapists or pharmacists or what have you. So,
well, I think follow up. I think if I was designing the study, and I'm not doing that, but I've done some of that in the past, I'd use survey data to see what the community thinks their needs are, and also ratio data, you know, set an objective analysis of it and match the two and make the best decision.
Mm-hmm. And then say anything that falls below 80% of workforce need, if you're not meeting 80% or whatever percent you decide, that's where we're, you know, because if you just say some number here, we don't know what that is with regard to the workforce.
How much is the study going to cost?
Right. So, I mean, Chair, I could go with either two or four. I could see arguments either way. Two would give us an opportunity to really see what the workforce needs are, and we would just be looking at the credit with regard to the workforce need. Four would get it back in alignment with the others and would allow us to look at this tax credit along with all the other information, loan repayment. I could argue either way. I do think that I would really like to offer an amendment to say that people who have to be there for 3 years because of the loan forgiveness program should have that taken out of the 10 years. That, I feel like, is there any reason not to do that right now? They have to be there, and they're getting free medical education.
I think they have a commitment that's very clear.
But they have to have a commitment of 3 years, correct?
3 years per year or 3 years total?
Chair Greenlee, it depends upon the program. For loan forgiveness, it's year for year. For the scholarship program through OHSU, Scholars for Healthy Oregon, it's 4 years. Their program of study plus 1 year.
We also incidentally have two bills in our agenda that call for one or the other of these programs for urban underserved as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that one of them? Your bill?
Right.
My bill. And what do we do with those? Which is,
hear them and pass them.
There's as much argument for those as there is for this.
Well, there is, and that's the issue.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to we keep talking about the studies, but I know in one of the other task forces I serve, and I know there's some analysis that has been going on for some time about workforce, especially in specific categories of workforce, and I know OHA has been involved, or there's actually a workforce committee, or I'm not sure, I'm messing this up, but I've heard just enough to be dangerous, but I do know that there already is some work going on about identifying some workforce gaps, and I'd like to understand that a little bit more as we talk about this, because we may not have to reinvent the whole wheel here.
Are you thinking about the Workforce Committee on the Oregon Health Policy Board?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, we could ask them for some.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, they did do quite a bit of work gathering data, and they issued a report that their number one recommendation was fund Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute and Oregon Center for Nursing to do
a study.
A study, because data is one thing, the analysis and evaluation is another. And so while we can tell you how many people are practicing where, we don't know if that's meeting the needs. We don't know what incentive would help to meet those needs, which program works better, is more effective than another. Those are the more analysis and evaluation type questions that need to be answered.
Thank you.
So we have as much information to pass the bill as to not pass the bill. I'm sorry. Representative Hayden.
And Chair Greenlee, my suggestion would be to extend it 4 years and get some of this gap analysis and the efficiency of those providers and get some real data so we can study it. If it's impossible to do that and add pharmacists, maybe we'd put the pharmacy bill off for 2 years and use a portion of those potential funds to do the study, with the caveat that, you know, if it is efficient, we add the pharmacists back in 2 years.
Well, and all that depends on getting the Senate bill passed and funded.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'd say 4 years.
No, we could reduce the worth of the tax credit if a study, which I'm not sure why it costs $250,000.
I just
study.
Made that number.
Okay,
up.
But let's just go with that just for fun. All right. It's a better. If we reduce everybody's tax credit by $120, we could fund the study.
That's a better approach.
Right, 2,000. You know, it's 2,500 divided by 2076.
You can write that amendment.
I might
when that
actually.
Bill comes over.
I'm feeling really smart right now.
You're looking smart.
Thank you very much for.
We could put a tax.
No, Scott,
on
you have a final. We'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Chair Greenlink. You're being
that would be popular.
Very generous. I would just want to add that when you look at the map and it shows number of people receiving the credit in a particular community, and some seem particularly large. Let's say Ontario, for example. Okay. There's a lot of people getting the credit in Ontario. It's important to remember that they're the largest population center in that area, and they are drawing people from Idaho and through all throughout southeastern Oregon. There's probably quite a few that actually live in Idaho that are coming over from Idaho to practice. And the same thing goes for Hood River. They draw a lot of people from Washington. The same thing to be said for northeastern Oregon, drawing a lot of people from Washington. And the larger the population center, some that, you know, if you're from eastern Oregon, you might not even consider them necessarily to be rural on the western side of the state. But if they're larger population centers, then you need a different mix of providers and more providers because there's more people to see. So simply looking at the number of people receiving the credit does not necessarily mean they're flush with providers.
I understand that for Ontario. I'm a little less certain about that for Ashland.
Actually, there's a big metropolitan area half hour away from Ontario, and then another one even closer.
From Ashland,
Boise.
You've got Medford very close. All right, guys, thank you so much for coming in without much notice. I'm going to close the work session on 2125, and we are adjourned. Have a safe trip home. And we are adjourned. Have a safe trip home.